Hey there, my name's Mark McCartney and welcome to the What is a Good Life podcast. Over the last 3 years, I've interviewed over 200 people around this question, not to prescribe you with a universal answer, but to help you to find and define your own answer to this question. I hope that in listening to the guests' explorations, investigations, lines of inquiries and experiences, that it will help prompt your own inquiries into this question. While I'm also trying to share with you what I perceive to be more genuine expressions of the human experience and indeed more meaningful conversations. Which brings us to this week and the 63rd episode of the What is a Good Life podcast, and I'm delighted to introduce Ada Paris as our guest. Ada is a futurist, an artist, keynote speaker, and a visionary in the fields of technology, ecology, innovation, and art. She chairs Mental Health First Aid England and is a fellow at the Royal Society of the Arts. She is recognized as a TED Talks Global Emerging Innovator, and celebrated by Forbes Brazil as one of the world's top futurists. In this episode, Ada shares her journey towards being herself, how curiosity and not following convention influence her life, the lessons she has learned about honesty and transparency in relationships, and meeting the human in each other before anything else. She notes the significance of seeing life as a series of experiments, and shares what contributes to both being a good ancestor and being in kinship with the world around us. If you find yourself stuck in life and are unsure of what to do next, or feel your present ways of relating to others are causing you much difficulty, Ada's perspectives will give you so much to contemplate across a breadth of themes and topics that may help you see the world a little differently. Look, I found it a real thrill to speak with Ada. It's rare to meet someone who's thinking about things across so many different themes and from so many different perspectives. And I feel much of what she's pointing to can be of real benefit or service to most of our lives. So I took a lot from this conversation, and I'm sure you will too. And if you enjoy this episode, please like, share, and subscribe. And if you're on the podcasting platforms, please continue to leave your lovely reviews, as it's really helpful to me at this stage of my podcasting journey. Also, please check out the notes below for links to Ada's work and also the program that she mentions in this episode. And also for my newsletter at www.whatisagood.life, as well as for ways to get in contact with me, whether for individual work or group leadership programs, for building more authenticity and trust and seeing the human in each other. So having said all that, let's get to this week's conversation and the 63rd episode of the What is a Good Life podcast. Ada, thank you so much for joining me today on the What is a Good Life podcast. After connecting with you last week, I've been really, really looking forward to this conversation today.
Thank you, me too. It's been, I know you've interviewed my really good friend Robbie, and so I've been, you know, our conversation last week was just beautiful. So I've decided today to come as a blank slate, and let's just go.
That was my most favorite thing I could hear in this situation, to be honest. So I won't delay, and I shall ask the first question, as I always tend to do, which is there a question you're trying to answer as you move through life?
Yes, and I feel very fortunate that I have finally found what that question is, and it is, what type of ancestor do you want to be? And I feel that it's the question of, number one, it's the only question any of us should be asking right now, especially in these global tipping points and everything. But I recognize that it's a question I've been trying to ask since I was a child, who fell in love with Mr. Spark and Star Wars and Sky, you know, all of those things. And I was just always, injustice would make me cry, regardless of who it was to and what it was. And I've always cared very deeply about connection. So human connection and connection with nature and all of these things. And I've always also tried to be, it was interesting. So what suddenly popped into my head is that I'm the eldest of three. And I have my Nigerian Igbo father, Guyanese, South American Amerindian mother. And my childhood was about what do people think and how are we presented to the world. And, how, you know, there were things around, make sure you never disappoint yourself. And I think not disappointing myself, it helped me to create my values, which I feel are probably very similar. So, very similar in when I was younger and now where I am now. And that those are humility, curiosity, playfulness, diversity, transparency. So all of those kind of things. And now just thinking about that, what type of ancestor do you want to be? Question. I'm suddenly, I'm remembering and kind of reliving some of the things that I've done in my earlier life, and how each one has been like a waterfall into the other that has really helped me to strengthen and deepen my understanding of those values and this question. So it's really interesting that people, with the work that I do now, people keep saying to me, oh, you're really brave. And I don't understand that, I suppose, because, oh, I, firstly, I'm acknowledging that's the way that they think and that's the way that they see. But from a very neurodiverse perspective, I don't really understand that, because I'm just the way that I am. And I always have been this way. And it's just that I've now got more language, more context, more experience to be able to express that.
I love this image of the waterfall. Can you give us a sense of just kind of how these things have kind of cascaded into the other almost?
Yeah. So on the personal front, recently I have, in the last kind of 18 months, been diagnosed with ADHD, combined ADHD, hyperactive and inattentive, and borderline autism. And when I was going through that process of assessment, my mum had to fill a form in about my childhood. And, you know, and it was really interesting to notice that there were signs. We didn't have the language then, but there were signs. And one of those signs, that, I'm not sure why, maybe why it popped up now, is that I now understand, and my mum now understands why she put me into ballet and gymnastics and all those things, so I could just throw myself at things and exhaust myself. And those things have also nourished my love of nature, because we used to spend time in the forest just running and building huts and all sorts of things. And now I can trace back to those times of running and connecting and my curiosity in nature of, I remember once I got lost in the woods and the first thought was, right, I have to build a hut. And I know how to build a hut. It was daytime. But this idea of that earlier, let me run my child, let me get my child to burn out her energy in nature, has also led to my beauty, my beautiful curiosity about immersing myself in nature. On the work front, I was studying to be a primary school teacher and doing pure and applied maths, and I just hated the education system and the way that we were doing it. I said, there's another way. So I chose to do educational studies, and that led me to my second job at out of uni was at London Business School. And I used that educational studies piece to work in the marketing department of the MBA program to help, and I was working on the course packs. So that helped me to understand how people think, how people learn, how we process information. That then led me to being really curious about their mini MBA, their Center for Marketing program. So I did that. And that was about communication and really understanding the processes, the methodologies, the science behind communication. That led me to go and work in advertising, but not the agency side, but the business side. So I then understood how people communicate, how you design educational learning models, and now I'm in advertising. And started off there as a researcher, and then ended up, I saw a gap in what was happening. And so I ended up volunteering to look after some of their committees. So the organization I work for is the Institute in Practitioners in Advertising, and it's the membership organization for advertising agencies. And initially I started there as a researcher, but the organization had lots of various committees, so strategy, direct marketing, what have you. And I volunteered to look after some of them. So I choose business communication, strategy, direct marketing, and ethnic diversity. And by running those committees, I suddenly saw that there were things that both the various committees were doing. So I became a linchpin, you know, kind of bringing them together. And that led me to realizing that I'm working with the direct marketing lot to understand they don't get many people applying to come into they don't get many people applying to come and work in direct marketing. Most people wanted to work in the sexy agencies. And so I designed, using my London Business School knowledge, I designed a 10-week advertising program to bring in second-year university students in to experience what advertising was like in a direct marketing agency. And that became the advertising industry's graduate program. That then led me to then go and help Mark Lewis, amazing creative guy, to set up and run the School of Communication Arts. So advertising, again, not looking at university studies. From there, went to Telefonica. And at Telefonica, I designed and created and ran their first technology accelerator program. So you've got Learning Design University, London Business School, the IPA, School of Communication Arts, Telefonica. And all of that was learning design and communication skills drip feeding into the other. And so whilst working at Telefonica, I really got into technology. And I suddenly was like, well, where is the human in all of this? So all the stuff I had been doing as a child in nature and understanding nature, suddenly I'm in this tech company going, well, where's nature coming into this? You're not talking about nature or the human. And so that led me to then go into the Friday Club, which brought together marketing, advertising, communications people to work with technology startups. And from there, I kind of just went out on my own because suddenly I've got all the different pieces that I'd really studied, nature, innovation, technology, creativity. And now that's what I do. I bring all those things together.
There's something really beautiful about just being able to step back, I think, and just see, almost seeing the, you know, we talk about even human connection, but even just the different connections in life sometime like this.
Yeah.
Not necessarily just to make sense of it all or something, but just to see how, I don't know, life itself is kind of this emerging living thing that kind of that falls into place. Yeah. if we allow it to, or if we trust our curiosity. There's something you said there in your comment before that I also wanted to ask you about, this sense of you when you've connected with yourself in such a way that, you know, you don't see what you're doing as brave. It's just you are being who you are.
Yeah.
How has that evolved for you in that sense? How is there kind of such a comfort in like, oh, I am who I am?
Great question. That's been a long and tough journey. So as I said, now I understand that I'm neurodivergent and recognizing that one of my biggest heartaches growing up and even into adulthood was that I didn't really fit in and I couldn't really understand why I didn't fit in. And so that was most of the lens, especially my teenage years and young adulthood. That was the lens that I saw everything through, that I just don't fit. And I don't understand why I don't fit. Now that's the autism and I understand that. But for a long time, it was my biggest heartache. And I became great at masking at this. That's not being inauthentic. It's a neurodivergent way of trying to seem like everything is okay and trying to fit in. And so I've never been bullied at school. I got on with everybody, and interestingly for me it was just normal, but interestingly people would always say that I got on with the people with so many different groups of people, and I had this for a long time, what I used to say is, oh, I just sit on the outside of groups. I don't really get into the middle. And so I'd reframe the narrative that, no, I'm just on the outside and it's great because this is the position I like to be. When actually, I just didn't know how to fit in. And through some complex personal relationships, I lost my identity, lost any friendships I had, family, all of those things. And when that took back to back, when those relationships imploded and suddenly I was out, you know, out on my own again, it was, well, I remember one day I woke up and went, I don't even know how I like my eggs. I don't even know how I like things anymore, because I had lost all of that in trying to make these relationships work. And so the first thing I did was I went to group therapy, because I went, at some point, I'm going to blame a lot of what's happened on myself, and I need to also have that support. And I was intentional in exploring who I am. And so even silly, I mean, I say silly things, but I went through this period of going, the worst thing that can happen to me is I become bored of myself. So I'm going to try new things to see what I like. And so at the time, Groupon was huge. And so I just booked a load of Groupon sessions that I've never tried before. And I was like, well, what's the worst that can happen? I try something, I like it, I understand a bit more about myself, and actually recognize it. And that was my mother's attitude when we were growing up. Try things and see. And I hadn't made that connection. So I did classical sculpture, where you can only use your hands. And I was like, oh my God, this is teaching me patience. It was great and frustrating. I tried one class of pole dancing. My flesh is not made for those things. Oh my God, it's so painful. And I have a real respect for people who can do that. It is not easy. And then I tried belly dancing. So I did all these things. I did art and all sorts of things. And those helped me to work through, yeah, I like this. And what is it I like about this? And how can I kind of connect with them? So that was one part. And then there was another bit where I had a beautiful relationship. And then it went south. After a period of time, it went south. And we broke up. And I remember going, oh my God, I miss him. I miss that relationship. And then I went, well, what is it that I miss? And I said, I realized that what I missed was the intimacy. So I wrote this list, and I wrote down times that we were intimate. So I've always been experimental and kind of processing. So I wrote down this, a couple of times when we had been intimate, just as narrative. And then I went, well, what is it in that moment that I felt? I felt curious. I felt playful. I felt secure. I felt seen and heard and all of these things. And so I ended up with this list of characteristics. And then I set myself a challenge. And I said, for the next 30 days, I'm going to do one thing each day that helps me feel one of these things. And it cannot depend on anyone else. And I documented it, and I did it online. I did it on Instagram, just as putting it out in the universe. And the first couple of days, yeah, it was fine. And then you get to day 9 and suddenly I'm like, what am I going to do? I've got all these things. And yeah, it just became a really beautiful process of understanding how to be intimate with myself and how to love myself. And because I can't be in any other relationship, whether it's personal, you know, intimate, what have you, unless I understand myself. And so that became the journey and the narrative. And I just continue to do that. So now I take myself on dates and I love it. And I do all sorts of things and I try new things and I see life as a series of experiments. And the worst that can happen is it just doesn't work. And it's like, okay, didn't work, move on. So that's...
Oh man, so much of what you're saying there resonates even with my own experience as well. I almost love the sense, though, of... You know, usually when people talk about finding themselves or understanding themselves, it can almost be through very much like a therapeutic, you know, going to therapy, this kind of thing. Yeah. And while I think in my own experience that was definitely helpful, I think so much of life then just becomes a playground for this.
Yes.
And if it's only restricted to certain types of conversations or certain times of the week, that... It almost kind of like it doesn't take on a life of its own, and it's not going to be anywhere near as interesting as it could be. So I love this sense of even just a very real reflection of, I don't even know how I like my eggs. And then for that to kick off a series of experiments, I think it's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, and you're right, because I've got a great therapist. And the thing with therapy is people tend to think you have to be in crisis. There's no crisis, but it's a really beautiful way of reflection and sort of self-regulating and getting some tips, you know. So as much as I go out and I do my, you know, my self-dates and I try new things, it's also good to have somebody who is qualified in helping you to help through those processes, because you can talk to friends, but there are certain things that you may need somebody who's qualified who can give you a balanced view and a very particular perspective of what it is that you're doing.
Absolutely. There's the idea, though, that you've discovered for yourself through practice, like the sense of life as a series of experiments. How has that shifted your perception or experience of life?
I've got rid of perfectionism to a certain extent. There's still a bit of me that does it, and I'm holding my hands like this. But recognizing that my North Star is not everybody else's North Star, and that's okay. And so when I do my talks, well, actually, when I do anything, I always go back to the same quote, and I've said it several times, but it is, the purpose of a storyteller is not to tell you how to think, but to give you questions to think upon. And so I never say I'm an expert. I'm somebody who asks a lot of questions. I ask questions of myself. And so I don't feel that I could ask questions of others if I don't ask the same questions of myself. And so that's also important. But I also am not afraid of going into the discomfort. So if something feels uncomfortable, I'm now in a place of, that's probably the place that I need to go. So I'm not going to, it's very easy to put that off and go, oh, I'll do it tomorrow. And I'm just like, no, you know, I'm going to pause and go into it and find out what happens, find out what it really is. And for me, I believe that a lot of time those discomfort things are linked to ego. I want things to be a particular way, and I want it to be this, and I want, and I'm like, no, it's okay to say, I am going to do this. I'll give an example. One of my therapists recommended that I start art. I start doing art therapy, so I would start with a pencil and be doing tiny little lines like this. And one of my art tutor mentors went, take a pen and just start. And he said, get a notebook and create 100 little squares, different shapes and sizes in the notebook. And you just, when you're traveling around, you have to fill up those squares. So they can't be tiny little sketches like this. You have to take a pen, and you can't rub out the pen. So that got me through it needs to be perfect, it needs to be right, it's got to be a particular way, because I'm the person doing it. So I should know when it's enough, rather than thinking, well, I'm doing it for this. And because we create these hierarchies and these perceptions of what it should be, who we should be, and all of this. And that can lead to more heartache, because we're not fitting some predetermined social construct or box or some binary that it makes you, if we choose, because we have choice, we have agency, if we choose to go down that path of, well, I need to, at the age of this, I need to have this, and I need to have this house and all these things. When do we get to enjoy life? That's why I think it's experiments, because all the reading that we've done, all the self-help books, at some point we have to put that in practice, right? And putting it in practice is the experiment. And if it doesn't work, that's okay.
You know, I think you said something there really helpful, in the sense of, in those sketches, realizing that we can, you know, that it doesn't have to be perfect, or it doesn't even have to be a certain way. And it reminded me of a quote that a friend of mine often says, which he says is, not knowing is most intimate. And so the idea of, you know, you were mentioning earlier, more intimacy with yourself, and then even this process of not knowing what the various sketches in these 100 boxes would be. And then also the relationship with that, with not having presupposed ideas or even attached to timelines of expectation on our life, and the freedom that that, that can afford us as well. I think that's pretty significant.
And I think that, well, I don't think, I know for me that came with age as well, age and experience. So I am 52. And I really found myself in my 50s. I don't know. Yeah, there was just something that happened as a Black woman in this country, in the UK, born here, raised here, with all the social constructs and pressures and everything. I really found myself. I think, you know, perimenopause, yes, terrible and all sorts of things. And but there was also... not but, and there was also this sense of liberation of, oh, I just do not have the time or the inclination for that nonsense anymore. I am focused on enjoying myself, enjoying life, having deep, meaningful connections. Because you can know lots of people, but how many really close, heartfelt, challenging, good friendships should also challenge you, you know, that you... No, and I don't mean challenging in a fight. I mean that it's okay to have differences of opinion and different perspectives and still be in a beautiful, loving relationship. And that can be friendships and everything. So moving away from my 50s, especially, I moved away from that idea and that social construct thing of always needing to be right.
Right.
Because so many people argue the point about I'm right and you're wrong. And I've learned that the answer, my friend Kate, Dr. Kate Stone, and I were talking the other day, and we both got to this point of going, the answer is always yes and no. It depends on your perspective. And that shift has just made me go, it's okay. I don't have to agree with you. You have your own agency. You have your own choices about what you do. It's your business. I have a choice too. I can step away. And so I've done that recently with a few people who were in my life. I've just gone, we don't have to agree. And we can either choose to lean in and work a way of finding a middle ground, or we don't. That's okay. I don't have to hate you. You don't have to hate me. Life will still carry on. We just need to be on different paths. And maybe at some point we might come back together. But for now, that's all right. And it's so, it lets go. You're able to let go of, well, they did me wrong and no, and this, and I've been in, you know, it's an injustice. There are injustices in the world. They're much bigger than falling out with a friend. There are people starving, the planet is, you know, all this stuff. And so I just don't sweat that stuff anymore.
It's amazing when you're describing some of the things here or pointing to some things here. It's amazing the amount of baggage we carry around in normal ways of relating.
Yeah.
Like in really socially acceptable ways of relating.
Yeah. You know, the biggest, one of the most recent impactful things around the idea of relating that happened, or it didn't happen, I made a choice, is that I now understand that I've always been non-monogamous, polyamorous. I've always been. I didn't understand how, I didn't have a language for that. But around 2016, 2017, after doing some reading, what have you, I was like, oh no, this is who I am. And so I made a conscious choice that that's the lifestyle I'm going to live. And part of that was also was the very clear understanding of in any relationship, you have to talk. You have right. to be open about everything. You have to have this, some people call it radical honesty, but there are certain ways of relating that are just transparent and make so much sense. And suddenly I'm like, why aren't we doing this in every single relationship? Why is it only in polyamory or people who believe that's, you know, those are the foundations of polyamorous relationships, that there's transparency, there's trust, there's radical honesty, there are recognizing that there's no ownership of somebody. You are not my anything. And that there are many ways to love and to be loved and to show up. And it doesn't mean, and just because you say that you're polyamorous doesn't mean that you're out there sleeping with everybody. It just means that you are authentic in your relationships and you're authentic in your relationship with yourself first. And so suddenly I'm in this space of going, oh my God, this is applicable to everything. And so that making that decision to be authentic in recognizing that if I am dating more than one person, I'm never going to deny them to anybody. Suddenly that I was putting that into my work, and that's where my confidence in work came. Because I'm like, well, we have to talk about these things. So when I started working at, when I first became chair at Mental Health First Aid England, I was fortunate enough to choose my board because that timing was right. And so I chose people who are very different than me. And they were going, yeah, but I'm so different. I went, that's exactly why I'm choosing you. And then I said to my CEO, Simon, before we start working together, what we need to do is we need to connect as humans. So I need us to have a couple of workshops where we just see each other as humans. And we really understand each other, because at some point we are going to disagree, and that is okay. And we're all very different, and we're all big energy people. So we're going to disagree, but I would rather we disagree from a place of recognizing the human in each other, and recognizing also when sometimes it's, we just need to go, I don't need to say anything. My voice doesn't, I'm not just talking because I want my voice heard. And it meant that we've been an amazing board, and the things, times when we disagree and we also just go, yeah, you know what? Yeah, you're right. Okay. I know that that has come from making a conscious choice to be polyamorous and non-monogamous, because it is recognize a human, you have agency, everybody can have a different opinion. That's fine. And we can still make progress if we all believe in the same bigger picture, if we all have the same values, same with polyamory. My family, chosen family, we all have the same values. We all, you know, the same with work. We all have the same values. And so those things are connected.
There's so much you said here that I'd love to pick up on. You know, first of all, it's kind of crazy that it's called radical honesty, right? Like, because it's just... I think that probably tells us a lot about where we presently are, the fact that we call just being honest and saying what we think and feel is anything radical to it.
That stuff blows my mind. Because all the language that... And it's really interesting, because the language that's used in polyamory and community in those circles, why is it then that people look down at people who are polyamorous when we're actually being more open and transparent than anybody else? And you'll have people who go off and have affairs and all sorts of things and but what you're doing is wrong. I mean, really? The ethics and the morals and, you know, the honesty is there. So this idea that we have to be radical to be honest is nonsense. But that's the world that we're in.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think however anyone comes to these noticings, I think they just have such a profound effect on how we experience life. Like, it's not
really
that all our problems go away and we don't feel some kind of stress from life or whatever. But there's certain things you said there that I think communicating in a way that allows us to see the human in each other.
Yeah.
Because this is such a fundamental part that we're just fucking up so much.
Yes.
To go back to what you said earlier, it's rarely personal. Like, if someone has a different opinion than you, they most likely formed that opinion long before they ever knew of your existence.
Yeah.
And then I think, as you said, in those groups that you held with your board, where you got to engage with the human in with each other first, whether, and if we bring in the word intimacy again, like kind of sinking that connection a little bit deeper, you know, some of these things are considered a bit like, oh, these are just lovely things, or this is a utopia. Yeah, no, this allows you to argue. This allows you to have conflict, but then not see conflict as a reason to run to opposite sides of a room.
Yeah.
It allows you to stand there and respect each other in the conflict.
Yeah. It reminds me of the old debating societies. I'm all for bringing them back because they are curious, intellectual, and I don't mean that in IQ, but they are curious happenings where you can discuss and debate big ideas and, you know, and have this level of respect for the human, the respect for difference. You don't, and look, if there are some people who have morals and ethics that are definitely not mine, that, you know, there are some that have very nefarious intentions in the world. And we, of course, there are boundaries and there are things that, you know, I choose not to be involved in, and certain types of people I choose not to be around. But in many ways, that's the minority. So everybody else, I can have a disagreement with you and go, look, no, I think that I have a different opinion. That's okay. And it's important to have the difference because we are not a homogeneous, as much as some people try, we're not a homogeneous society. And I worry about communities that are so tightly bound by, we think the same, we look the same, we have the same values, because that doesn't allow space for difference. This planet is born out of chaos. So chaos is important and difference is important. And I mean, sometimes, even though I've seen and I know friends who've gone to live in intentional communities in certain places, I'm like, you all look the same, you all think the same, you all eat the same food. Where's the difference? Oh, yeah, if you come, yeah, I'm not going to be the one black person in your community, because then I'm an oddity. I'm this curiosity to you, and I'm too old for that crap.
Yeah. But it's funny you say that. Like, when I've been thinking, born in Ireland but living in Berlin, wondering, is this home?
Yeah.
Do we stay here for whatever period of time? And when different places have been suggested, and I think of, I hear of friends going to certain communities in Portugal, and I had the thought, like, even if there's a community just full of me.
I love that, the community of me, yeah.
Like, but if they were all very much just like me, in whatever way you want to define that, if it's from a curiosity, from a way of being, like, I'm not just saying it in a demographic kind of sense, but I'd probably hate it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's important to have that difference. It's,
and that difference
that difference doesn't take away. It's not reductive, it's additive, it's expansive, because we can learn so much. I mean, it's funny, the boundaries, just a scenario popped up, is the boundaries and the things that happen. So I remember once I was at a festival, Enlightenment, what have you, lovely, blah, blah, blah. I was there to talk about creating kinship. How do we create relationships? So instead of framing it as diversity and inclusion, I talk about it from a kinship perspective. And that means it's with the human and the more than human. And just before I went on to speak, I experienced two racist incidences. And I was disappointed because I'm in a place where people are saying that they're enlightened and what have you. And so I remember I was so mad. But I went, this is a growth, this is an educational opportunity. So I went on the stage and I said, I'm supposed to be talking about kinship. And I've just experienced these two racist incidences. And most of you here will say you're enlightened because you've gone to Peru and you've done this and blah, 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 and you're vegan because of the animals. And that, does that mean that your enlightenment doesn't transcend being racist or homophobic? Because if that's the reality, none of you have the right to say that you're enlightened. Because you're not eating the animals because of the little animals in nature. And I'm not taking the piss out of vegan.
No, I understand.
But you're not going to eat the animals because of the planet and because of love and blah, blah, blah. And yet you can treat your fellow human like crap. Like, what does that mean? How can you say that you're enlightened and that you're, it becomes this hierarchy, this escalator of enlightenment where the other humans who you don't think fit are at the bottom of that. That's not what this world is about or should be about. So that's why I am very intentional in every homeless person I pass. I make sure that I look them in the eyes and recognize them and say, I'm sorry. If I've got cash, who has cash these days? But there is something about, which is very, it's the core of who I am, going back to patterns, that's who I was as a child, in making sure that other people are seen and look them, in the face and say, hello, I'm sorry. If the postperson comes now, generally any time that something drops through the door, I shout, thank you. Even if I'm in a call, thank you. It's that acknowledgement. That's what we need more of, especially in this current climate.
Yeah, I think whatever anyone's journey is, if you don't see a change in how you see or perceive or feel other humans, and I know you said that there can be difference and we can celebrate that and the world is chaotic.
Yeah.
I also love a sense that there's something just in a human's very essence that we're like, just like everything, that we're connected to, that we're a part of. And I think if we can't engage or if we don't engage or connect with that, then we can read whatever we want or repeat whatever words we want. But they're pretty hollow words,
Yeah. I'm smiling because a partner of mine, his foundation is presence. He's like, more than anything, it's about being present for ourselves, present for others. And I agree, that is the core of much of being able to, being intimate is being present for yourself or for others. Being curious is being present. Being an artist and creating art is about being present and creating space for presence. So as an artist, I feel that I feel that my role or our role as artists is to create the spaces for those moments of presence. So we shift time in being able to go, I'm going to take this time to look at this work of art and everything else stands still just for that moment. Or I create sound art that allows people to put their headphones on and just shut everything else out. And just go on this journey of listening and creating their own pictures. That's why I call them virtual reality experiences. Because the best virtual environment is our imagination, right? So if I can create I smiled again because it's kind of witchy, right? And I love that. Creating these spaces and these moments of presence and stillness and pause and the opportunity to exhale, because we're so tightly bound up with I need to do this, and that it's beautiful to be able to be trusted so that people know that they may feel a little bit uncomfortable but they still choose to come on that journey with you. That's why I love what I do.
The idea of distorting time, and then so much of what you've said at different points, and not like rejecting convention, but just literally finding what you enjoy or what you're desiring to do or what's an expression of you,
yeah,
and simply doing that. And that seems to be, you know, when we think about how we all show up to our own lives, that ability just to express ourselves quite simply, because, and this isn't an us or them kind of scenario, but I just personally think that if we don't take that time to find what we want and express that in some way and be honest about it, it doesn't mean that we're not entitled to anything, you know, nothing is promised. Yeah. But just that simple act of just going, okay, I see the structures that exist and how other people are perceiving that they must engage with these structures, yeah, but I see it somewhat differently.
Yes. And that's okay. And that's, so talking about my work at the moment, that's what I'm now doing. I've done many jobs as we spoke about earlier, but last year I had the opportunity to go to Brazil to speak at two conferences. I was there twice. And that was a beautiful gift to myself in many ways, because it became a vision quest. And it reminded me of, it's funny because at the start of the year, I said, I need to do another 10-day Vipassana. So the silent meditation retreat. And the date that I wanted, I just couldn't get on. And I went, oh, okay, I'm going to have to find another way to do a Vipassana. And I ended up going to Brazil twice and hiking in the national, Chapada Diamantina National Park, and having those moments of silences and those moments of stillness and removing all the noise of technology and deadlines for work, and realize that that's what I want to do. So the next iteration of my work is, I've now created a 12-week leadership transformation program, which is coaching, one-to-one coaching. And it is, I've created it as a vision quest. So it's taking people on those journeys, and with my AI, mental health, futurism, creativity. So lots of the different perspectives and ideas in the talks that I've done, I've woven those into the program. And I'm excited because it's that opportunity to help people work out what their big question is, what their reason is, more than the why, the Simon Sinek why. It's the, what's the very visceral thing that comes through you, that somatic, that are you going to go to a classical sculpture class, and what is a thing you're going to shape out of the clay and get fed up with the fact that as much as you look, it's still not straight? That's okay. Yeah. What's the curiosity, what's your lens on how you recognize the other human and create the spaces or distort time, all of those things. So that's what the coaching program is, the leadership program is. And the way that I've put it together is that it's never going to be a big cohort going through it at the same time, because there's something beautiful in that one-to-one, you know, attention, being able to be sharing this level of intimacy and connection together. So I'm excited for it.
And that sounds beautiful. And I think there's something quite interesting in a world that seems to want to scale everything as rapidly as possible. How can you 10x something? We're getting away from kind of what seemed to me like fundamental properties of relating.
Yeah.
Like, you cannot replace time or attention with something else, like, yeah, or attention, whatever our concept of time is or whatever, but particularly, like, you can't dilute that attention and say it's the same attention. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's not to knock anything else or to say anything else or to say that other interventions aren't very useful, but there's certain things in our scaling that I think that we're moving away from some really obvious things as well.
Yeah. We are, to your point, we're removing some of the fundamentals of relating. So technology to me is about relationships. And I think that we forget that. And when I say technology, I mean all technology, is just not just digital. So technology in my work and ideas and kind of patterns that I've recognized, it does three things: help us to connect with and understand ourselves, others, and our environment. So that could be AI, it could be a mobile phone. That could also be going down the shamanic route and doing plant medicines or meditation. I was brought up Catholic. It could be that I was taught to believe in a God who I cannot see, who helps me understand self, other, and environment. It may be music, it may be art. There are so many things that we use to do those three things that it doesn't always have to be, I'm going to go and use the latest VR headset to connect with people. I could go for a walk with my friends in the forest. That, to me, is another form of relating. I could sit. I mean, you know, instruments and sound and all these things, there are so many ways that offline and slower and help us to reconnect with patience, because we've created cultures of busyness. Too busy to do this. I'm too busy to do that. I find it's. I mean, I do it because that's where my life is at the moment. But I try to move away from the fact that I have my friends and I sometimes have to book dates in the diary that we're going to see each other in 6 weeks. I'm like, this is insane. Sorry, and I shouldn't use that word. This is it's a sign of the times, and one that I'm fighting against.
I'll use the word insane instead. I'll take the shortcut.
Well, you know, the reason I say that is I'm mindful of language.
Understand. You
know, with mental health and everything. So it's, and this, see, this is also part of it, right? Being really mindful of the language that we use. There's several times during this conversation that I start saying, but, and I go, no, and. And I pick, we're human, so sometimes we will, you know, mess up and say things or what have you. Or language is complicated. And I'm also very mindful of the language that I use, especially towards myself and towards others. Because, you know, people talk about sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. They do. They can cut right through. So the intentionality is also important.
No, I fully agree with that. The busyness, the part though, I remember just being, I lived in London once for a year, and I just remember being stunned when asking some colleagues, do they fancy doing something that Thursday evening? And it was Thursday. And they said, no, but how about in 3 weeks' time?
Yeah.
And so like London for me was a big eye opener in terms of the intensity of the busyness there versus other places that I've been. And I think this idea of, I don't know, like it's as much as we blame work at times and claims on our time from external sources, I find it remarkable kind of what we're doing, I guess, voluntarily, like, you know, that or over parts of our life, you know, I know we're all at the whim of our culture and the environment. So I'm not saying that any no man is an island type thing, but there's something very intense about that kind of scheduling for me, for what you described there again, like this idea of cultivating patience.
Yeah.
And, you know, and patience with ourselves.
The hardest things for me. I'm not patient at all, especially, you know. However, there is definitely something about recognizing that. That's a starting point.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, you know, you've mentioned attention or awareness at different times. And it's not to suddenly say that my behavior will, you know, just like that, everything's going to change tomorrow. No, but as long as I keep paying attention to it, I'm probably going to be much less defensive over what's staring me in the face at times. And, you know, just going back to even what you've said in multiple times in terms of relating or connecting or intimacy, just sharing that I've noticed, I think, can make a big difference.
Yeah, because people want to be seen, right? They want to be seen and recognized and that their lived experience is valid. Nobody can take away our experiences, and so it's valid, but you also don't have to agree with it.
Absolutely. An expression you've used a couple of times, which I love because I think it's just a beautiful expression. So I just love you to elaborate on it. The distortion of time, or distorting time.
Yeah.
You've mentioned it in terms of music or sound experiences. Could you elaborate on that term?
Thank you. Yeah, we have to remember that our relationship with time is a construct. We created the calendars, and you know, so it's interesting, the more I've kind of looked into time, the more when people talk about calendar, I'm going, which calendar are you using? Because there is this dominance of one particular calendar when there are actually so many different ones. And so remembering it started, I was trying to think about when did I start? I can't remember when I started really. Maybe it was from Star Trek. You know, this idea of time as a construct, and that we have choices. I mean, that, and this bit is definitely in my adulthood, not as a child, because that would have been interesting. But having this idea that we keep saying, I don't have enough time. However, we still have choice, we still have agency. And so I choose to look at things as priorities. So if I am waiting, expecting someone to message me, this is what I think most people will get, you know, have experienced, and it can also cause a lot of frustration, because I know it did for me. You know, the idea of, oh, I've sent you a message, but you haven't responded. And I know that you've been online and you've done, because this is it, right? I know you've been online and you've responded in groups and you've done this stuff with other people and blah, blah, and you still haven't responded to my message, and you get frustrated. Well, why haven't you? I was like, you know what? Responding to you is not a priority. Responding to me is not a priority. Now I have to recognize that that's okay, rather than going, oh no, I don't mean anything to you and I'm not a priority, because then that's your ego kind of going into things and going, I'm not a priority. You've got other things. Why do I need to worry about whether or not I'm a priority for you? You respond. So when people miss, you know, when people respond to messages, sometimes they've gone, oh, I'm really sorry, I didn't respond quicker. I went, that's the beauty of mobile phones, right? You can respond when you're ready. I'm a big believer in, you know, things happen when at the right time. Oh, there's been people that our paths have crossed several times, but we've never actually met or sit down and have a conversation. And I'm not worried about that. We will do it when we're supposed to. And by that time that we've actually got to there to be able to have the conversation, it's okay. So that, all of that is the distortion of time. It's the choosing how we prioritize and how we have those moments of presence and how we give ourselves the space to exhale and go, I'm going to step off the hamster wheel for a bit, and the wheel's still going to be turning. The life didn't stop because I've stepped off the hamster wheel.
That's I think that's a beautifully helpful observation, and it goes back a little bit again, I think, to, you know, not taking other people's actions personally. And you know, just, you mentioned Vipassana earlier, and I remember I've done two in my lifetime, but the first one I did, I remember coming out and just turning on my phone and realizing the world just went on without me.
Yeah.
And there may be a few more messages to respond to, but yeah. I'm not the center of anyone else's universe, and that's okay.
And that's the part of what we do, right? We center the world and the universe around ourselves. And I don't just mean that as in personal relationships, I mean the planet, the world. It's like we are going to go and colonize other places because we are the supreme beings. And so this idea of centering things around ourselves is so egotistical. And you know, if people say, oh, I'm a feminist, you know, I've asked men before, you know, they'll go, oh, I'm a feminist because I've got daughters and I've got a wife and mother. I'm like, you're still centering it on yourself. We should do these things because they are the right thing to do. So that's the bit that when we were talking earlier about me saying I don't understand, it's just that that's how I see the world, right? Do the right thing because it's the right thing to do, not because it's going to impact me, not because it's going to impact mine. There's many kind of things I've got involved in. There's nothing to do. It's nothing. I don't have that lived experience. But I recognize that it is something that needs to be addressed, and it needs to be addressed as part of a collective. And so I will get involved, you know, but not well. And so, for example, right now, with everything that's happening in Israel and Palestine, I am a part of a WhatsApp group where it is Israeli and Palestinian women coming together to try and talk about what can be done. And, you know, and also looking at it from a mental health perspective. You know, it's, and then I have people saying, well, you're not putting anything publicly online, and you're not, why do I need to do that? That makes you feel better. What, to know that I'm doing something rather than letting it be, and understanding that sometimes there are things that we can get involved in that doesn't need to be loud and shouty and all of those things. And it's still about recognizing the human in all humans. A friend of mine once, a few years ago, 2019, I remember, we were at an event in Venice and we sat on these steps and just talking and just watching the world go by. And he said to me, the biggest lottery in life is when and where you were born. Those are the things we don't have any choice over. And
absolutely.
That says it all, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's lots of research as well to suggest the biggest predictor of your wealth will be the wealth of your parents. Yeah. You know, just looking at the time and also, not that I want to be bound by it, obviously, but just what you said there, like recognizing the human in all humans, just considering what you opened up with, you know, of how can I be, you know, a good ancestor to, like, is that essentially the crux of what leads you then to fulfill that? Like being a good ancestor,
I would expand it so that being a good ancestor is not just to humans. So yeah, it's that, going back to that bit I said about kinship. So being a good ancestor is being intentional and conscious of the decisions that I make, of the ripples that I put out into the world, because those ripples will last longer than me. And so on my website, actually, you'll see it, my pronouns are she, her, and kin for kinship. I'm being just much like my polyamorous, being not wanting to not acknowledge people who are part of my life. I'm also choosing to acknowledge that nature. And some people go, oh, that's a bit weird and whatever. I don't really care. It's my outward statement of, I am acknowledging that I am part of a bigger living, breathing kinship with all that is more than this planet.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know, I keep on having this sense that that's almost like the deeper reality at play beyond the limitations of our senses, like our human senses, and perhaps even what other people could be in tune with already, but that they're not seeing or perceiving the world through some of the, I don't know, through some of the structures in which we've kind of embedded within us, yeah, through repetition or exposure to messaging and things like this. Because I think, I don't know, there's something about feeling at home in this universe, let alone this life or this world, that deeply resonates with me.
Yeah, definitely, because this is home, right? This is the planet that we have found ourselves on, and it doesn't have finite resources. And there have been species of this planet on this planet before us that are no longer. So the idea that we are going to be the ones that are going to be eternal on this planet, I find hilarious, because what makes us so different? Look, maybe there were, who knows, right? Who knows? The dinosaurs may have thought that they were here, the Homo sapiens, what have you, all those other, we will not exist in the form that we do. You know, there's always this process of transformation and evolution, and we are just another part of that process. And I mean, I'm smiling because there's also this part of me that goes, the earth is, it sometimes gives us nudges, get off, stop doing that. You know, like something like the fly. It's like, oh, that mosquito, that's that is getting it. And we're not listening. So we are part of this, and we forget that what we are creating is creating us. What we are destroying is destroying us. It's that simple. So the what type of ancestor do you want to be? Is that we can't remove ourselves from this interconnected, interrelated relationship with the planet. Much of our digital technologies initially started off as linear, and they're becoming more holistic, you know, blockchain, all that. And what they're doing is they're replicating nature. So I find it strange and interesting that instead of going for a walk and going and seeing a tree, there are places and cities now that have created these digital trees. I'm like, why? The idea of uploading your mind and your consciousness to the cloud, isn't that what happens in meditation? Group. So there's all these things that, and the more I go out and speak about those things, you know, AI being like water is everywhere. And if we poison the river upstream, we're only going to get more poison, we poison the whole system. If the AI models are built on broken systems, broken knowledge, we're just creating more. So the AI can't suddenly take over us. You know, it can't suddenly, we are the ones doing this to ourselves, and we're not recognizing that we are part of that. And so a lot of my work started from this idea of, okay, it feels like we're looking for a new religion. We're looking for something external to ourselves to put the blame on and negate our responsibilities. And well, we've seen where that ends up before. It's not that far away that things that we can see that behavior, and yet we somehow seem to think that we are not susceptible to what we're creating. This is why I suppose that I'm the, this is just how I am. This is just how I see it. You don't have to agree with me, but I don't see it as I'm being activist. These are the very foundations of many civilizations and cultures and things that happen in nature. And I'm choosing to remember that, and I'm choosing to live that lifestyle.
I love you said the word remembering a number of times, and I love that way to capture so much of this, because it's even so much of what we're doing, it's not something new, even though the label of what we're doing may be different.
Yeah.
And I think so much of, not answers or solutions, but we could find a lot of, I think we could find a lot more ease in our lives by remembering some fundamental things. And, you know, throughout the course of this conversation, whether it's opening up with the idea of what kind of ancestor do I want to be, identifying your values, identifying who you are, and moving beyond constructs or expectations on your life, and deciphering through reflection, through experimentation, through letting go of, to some degree, as you say, of perfectionism, all of these things, to, you know, identifying ways of being and ways of seeing each other that don't have to eradicate difference, but we can relate to the humanness, and that extends to in a sense of kinship with the rest of the planet as well, or the universe as well. And just, I don't know, it all, whether it's the use of the word intimacy or whatever else, so much of it just points to, you know, we mentioned the word radical honesty. How about just honesty? You know, like, this doesn't have to, someone may seem radical by pointing to some of this, but it seems like we're pointing to the nose on our face, like generally, like it's there, and we just have to look, and once we do that, perhaps, I don't know, perhaps this life for ourselves individually or collectively might just get a little bit, we may be in more harmony than with it than fighting it.
Look,
you've shared so many fascinating ideas, so many lovely ideas that I've just touched on there. But I'd love to ask you the final question, Etta, which is, what is a good life for you?
A good life is the one that you've just described. It is, and look, I'm not saying that everything is okay, everything is wonderful, because that's also part of it. Part of life is that there will be things that don't go our way, and there will be chaos, and there will be frustration. And that is also a part of the human, you know, experience. So a good life is one of presence. Yeah. And like I said, remember, I'm not that patient. So it's a constant battle. But it's a battle that I choose to go into. And over a period of time, it does get easier. It's easier to get into that space. But there are times when, you know, you flare up and you go, oh, I'm really angry about this. And I go, okay, why am I angry? What is it? Is it anger or is it something else? And so that is the practice of going inside and being present and really investigating. You know, who's Tara Brach? Amazing. So she has a mindfulness practice called RAIN. Recognize, see if I can remember. Recognize, allow, investigate, and nurture. So recognize feeling that's come up, this, and then allow yourself to be able to be present in that feeling. Go, I'm feeling it. Investigate, where is it coming from? So is it ego? Is it frustration? Is it not being heard? Is it lack of intimacy? And then nurture yourself. And so, you know, a partner introduced me to that practice. And when I do get those, you know, and letting that out instead of holding that in, and then go through that RAIN practice, I'm like, okay, I was being a bit of a dick. It's all right. I was being a diva. It's okay. I recognize that now. And so now I go, learn the lesson quicker, so that I don't have to repeat the depth and the breadth of those cycles.
I think that's a beautiful note to leave us with there. Look, Etta, thank you so much for joining me on the What is a Good Life podcast today. I've enjoyed the hell out of this conversation with you once more, and I'm really grateful for your time.
Thank you for the invitation, and I am looking forward to getting this out in the open.